Dwayne, you got them started? Okay. Let's get in here and close these doors, and we're going to try to cover some very interesting material. We're going to try to get the kernel, at least, of chapters 8, 9, and 10. You know, some of you that were in here, I saw Jeanette and it made me think of it. She was gone to Bladewater this weekend, had requested the Acts tapes from last semester and mailed out a bunch of them all over the country to people that had requested them. But it was in mid-semester that we got our real good cassette recorder out there. And Dwayne, by the way, after 45 minutes, did you kind of watch it to go turn that over? So some of our tapes were kind of poor quality, and I just hadn't listened to them. And we had some requests for the whole set of Acts tapes. I knew, Horace, that you had your bid in for a set, and also for Pat Jones wanted a set, I think. And I got to listening to some of those tapes, and they were terrible quality, so I just took the reel-to-reel masters and made a whole new set that's really, really good quality. And so now that I have the masters, I know you've already sent some to your dad, but I think of them, some of them were subpar. So I've got a whole set of the 20 lessons if you'd like them. And anyone else in here that wants Acts now and wants a good set of it from last semester, good quality recording, I can run you off a set if you'll just give me your name and tell me what you need on that. Now, tonight, we're going to be talking in 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9, and 10. Now, at the end of the class, we'll talk just for a minute about the test that I'm going to be giving out to you and how to regard the test and what our objectives are on it. Last semester, we went through chapter 8 before I gave the test, and then I gave the test covering through chapter 8. But I think that it was well that this time we made the test go only through chapter 7, and we're going to consider chapters 8, 9, and 10 as a unit. Now, what I want you to do is have open minds. Don't be thinking ahead of me on anything that is said here. You might take some isolated remark that I will make and could quote it out of context, and somebody get the impression, my goodness, that Bill McQuestion is just a rank liberal. And so what I want you to do is take everything I say in the context of the entirety of the lesson. And, of course, you'll be able to get a tape of this lesson if you want to go over it again. Now, to set the stage of chapters 8 through 10 as a unit, we need to consider some facts, and you might take notes on some of these things that you deem important and what you can remember, that's fine. The average Christian... Yes, sir?
Before you go into that one, would you explain verse 39 and 7 just a little bit?
Verse 39. A wife is bound for so long a time as her husband liveth, but if the husband be dead, she is free to be married to whom she will only in the Lord. Is your question in regard to only in the Lord?
No, the wife is bound so long as her husband liveth.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to... contradict the idea that you could remarry in verse 15.
All right, well now bear in mind in my answer to the question that I would not be adamant that a person could remarry according to verse 15. However, the explanation for that is God's law of marriage. The general law of marriage is one man and one woman until death. And that law is repeated in Romans, the 7th chapter, where the apostle is comparing marriage to the law of Moses. And he says that that a woman is married to a husband as long as they live, but if he be dead, then she's free to be married to whomsoever she will, you see. She's freed from the law of her husband. So when you have a law, the law is one man and one woman, then that is till death. Now that's the law. Now, God hates anything other than that. And the only way that some other situation can prevail, I think I gave you Malachi, the second chapter, where God said, I hate putting away. The only way that some other situation can prevail than one man and one woman to death is by there being sin. Now, Jesus gave an exception to God's universal law on marriage. And that is reiterated in Matthew 5:32 and 19:9. And these laws say, whosoever shall put away his wife and shall marry another, except it be for fornication, committeth adultery, and whoso marrieth her that is put away doth commit adultery. All right, now, the word except shows that what the Lord said in Matthew 19:9 is not part of the law, but it is an exception to the law. Do you see? In other words, it is not part of God's law that a man should put away his wife for fornication. The law is one man and one woman till death. And then Jesus says, but there's an exception to that. An exception is an extenuating circumstance that takes a situation out of the ordinary realm of what the law says and allows for something else to be done in that extenuating circumstance. So here is the exception. So all that Paul is doing in verse 39 is stating God's general law on marriage. God's general law on marriage is one man, one woman till death. Now, if you took this passage, let me point out, Bill, and said nothing else could ever have any bearing on that, then even Matthew 19:9 could not apply.
Well, if you look in the other two Gospels, the except is not there either. You know, say for instance, Luke 16:18 is not there.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark 10:11-12 not there either.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so that in one place in Matthew is the only place that gives any exception.
Plus Matthew 5:32. Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9. Okay, does everyone understand God's law on marriage? This is what he desires, is one man, one woman till death. But there's an exception to the law, and the exception is fornication. Could I cover the phrase, only in the Lord? There are generally two positions in connection with only in the Lord. Some people believe that only in the Lord means, of course, the phrase in the Lord is usually used to mean what in the Bible? If I say this, here's a person, he's in the Lord, you mean he's in Christ, he's a Christian. And sometimes the phrase apparently is used to mean, as a secondary meaning, in harmony with the Lord's will. For example, in the book of Ephesians, where the Lord tells children to obey their parents, that is apparently the meaning. In Ephesians, the sixth chapter, in verse 1, he says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. And a lot of people will take the position, obviously, the phrase here, obey your parents in the Lord, does not mean only if they're Christians. But obey your parents in the Lord means obey your parents to the extent that what they tell you to do is in harmony with the Lord's will. You see? So, some people come back over to here and they say that in this verse, she's free to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. that doesn't mean he has to be a Christian, but in harmony with the Lord's will. Well, even if you take that meaning, I think that you can see that it would be the Lord's will for any Christian to marry a Christian. Anything other than that is less than ideal. Now, somebody says, what if a Christian just goes ahead and violates that and marries a non-Christian? Well, he's done something that he oughtn't to do, but what does he do? Well, Paul has already covered that. Paul says, if you're married to an unbeliever, don't put them away. See, stay in that marriage. Now, a lot of people can't understand how it can be wrong to get into a situation and yet, after you get in it, the way to solve it is not to get out of it. In other words, they say, if it's wrong to get in it, obviously the only way to make it right is to get out of it. So they would say, if this says, let her be married to whom she will only in the Lord, that means let her marry a Christian. Now, if she goes out here and marries a non-Christian, the only way that to make that right is to divorce that person and marry a Christian. But Paul says, no, if you're married to an unbeliever and they're content to dwell with you, stay in that situation. And I gave an illustration last semester that I think pretty well illustrates that. That is, here's a young girl that goes out and commits fornication. Is that wrong or right? What's all the silence? I thought we'd covered that pretty well. All right, she commits fornication and she conceives. She gets pregnant here and she has a baby. Now, she needs to do some repenting, doesn't she? But what does she need to repent of? Was it wrong to have the baby, per se? No, the thing that was wrong, you see, sometimes we hear people talk about an illegitimate child. No child has ever been illegitimate. There is such a thing as illegitimate parents, but there's no such thing as an illegitimate child. Every child comes into the world just as innocent as it can be. And when we were talking about that, okay, she has the baby, but now she repents. I never should have gone out and committed fornication. And Ed McDonald spoke up and said, yeah, what's she going to do, kill the baby? In other words, what do you do to repent? Can she keep the baby? Yeah, she has to. Well, does this mean that she's enjoying the fruits of her sin? In other words, when she looks at that child and that child is the product of her sin, does she have to hate that child and resent that child and grow up with all kind of resentment towards that child because of her sin? No. Can you understand how she can hate the act of fornication and how she can be sorry she committed it and she can repent of having committed it and keep the child? In fact, she must. If she has any parental responsibility, she could adopt it out, but certainly it's her obligation to care for that child and rear it. Can you see that? So can you understand how a person can do something that violates the scriptures, like go out here and just marry a rank unbeliever, and now they're married to him? And probably every Christian that has done that, now some of them obey the gospel, and they become Christians. You win them over. But a lot of Christians have done that kind of thing and then have spent the rest of their lives realizing, I made a mistake when I married that person. But now I can't just divorce them, because Paul says if you're married to an unbeliever and they're content to dwell with you, you remain in that situation. You see? Dwayne?
Let me ask a question. Maybe explaining it, I'm just not understanding. If a person marries someone who's divorced,
mm-hmm.
someone who's divorced for unscriptural reasons,
mm-hmm.
okay, and Paul's saying here that person becomes an adulterer after he marries, and in case of meaning, if he sleeps with that person. Okay, mm-hmm. if that person, even after they're married,
All right, now, you're getting into a whole area that is different from Paul's discussion. Paul is not talking about unfaithfulness here. Now, let me say that if a person marries somebody that he has no right to marry, that is not scripturally able to be married, then in God's sight, that is not a marriage. And to get out of that is not like divorcing someone to whom you're legitimately married to. You see? That, in other words, the law of the land may have called it a marriage, but in God's sight, it never was a marriage. Okay?
So,
yeah, I'll just satisfy the law of the land, get out of it, legal entanglement, but really, in God's eyes, you never are married to them.
Yeah.
Just a shack up from the beginning to end, regardless of what the piece of paper says. See? If that person has no right to be married. But Paul is not comprehending situations of unfaithfulness here. For example, you're going to find a question on the test that says, for Christians, is divorce a legitimate option? In other words, when Paul says here, but unto the married I give charge, yea, not I, but the Lord, that the wife depart not from the husband, but should she depart, let her remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband. Just two options. Now, for the Christian, two Christians who are married to each other, is divorce really an option that the Lord just says, do it if you want to or not if you don't want to? No. He says, don't do it. But then if you do it, divorce anyway, what are your two options then?
Reconcile.
Remain unmarried or be reconciled. See, only two options. Now, what Paul says there in that situation does not even comprehend the case of marital unfaithfulness. If there is marital unfaithfulness, then this exceptive clause enters the picture that modifies the law that Jesus gave regarding marriage and divorce. Do you see? See? But Paul wasn't talking about the situation in which that happens. Any more questions?
I might ask now, when is a man and a woman married in God's sight today? You listed four things that constitute marriage here, a couple of lessons ago. But a couple living together, does that constitute marriage? Or just one night with each other, does that constitute marriage? When in God's sight is a man and a woman married?
Well, I would say that the ceremonies that I talked about, the ways of getting married, were simply society's ways of tying that knot and satisfying the law of the land. Now, if you were out on a desert island with someone, and you're the only inhabitants of that island, and there's a man and a woman, and both of you are single, you don't have a wife back home somewhere when the steamer sunk, and you look at each other, and he looks at you, and there's a few monkeys on the island, and coconuts hanging around, but other than that, you look pretty good, and so there's a temptation there, and so you know that you're not going to be able to have, as Paul says, continence. So because of fornication, it's good for every man to have his own wife and every woman to have her own husband. All you need to do is say, let's be married. Will you be married to me? And she says, yes. And you say, well, I'll be married to you. And you start living together. That's it. You are, in that situation, the law, and you agree to be married. Now, marriage, as I would understand it, involves several things. It involves agreement to be married. It involves sexual cohabitation, which is the consummation of the marriage. And it involves the fulfillment of whatever civil law states that you need to do. And civil law, from country to country and place to place, varies. There are some places in some countries where you can go and you go down to what's the equivalent of the city clerk's office and you each sign a piece of paper and you walk through an archway and you're married. The law of the state of Texas says you can do it several ways. You can have a ceremony, and that ceremony is just a formality. A couple can come to me and they have a marriage license and they want to be married. And they say, will you marry us? And I say, yeah, let me see your marriage license. Okay, you got your marriage license here. Do you want her? Yeah. You want him? Yeah. Okay, you're married. Bye. And then I sign the marriage certificate and send it in. And they're married. See? It doesn't say what kind of ceremony there has to be. I didn't know until I got here, and a couple of situations arose, and the elders, plus Herb Kaufman, told me about this other situation in the state of Texas where a couple can apparently agree to be married, can consummate the marriage, and then hold themselves forth to others as being married, and it is just as legitimate as had they gone down to the courthouse. Now, that has a shady appearance to me. I don't know. Maybe just because, you know, the way I grew up, that you need to get that ceremony and all. But apparently you can go down then after the fact and sign at the courthouse and get your papers that say you're married. And it's a legitimate and legal way of becoming married. But I would say that the three basic elements then are agreement, sexual cohabitation, and compliance with the law of the land. Assuming that they're free to marry each other. Assuming there was no marital tie that prevents there being a legitimate marriage. Because a person says, I agree to marry you, if he's still bound to somebody else that he just decided to shed, like a snake sheds its skin, he's not free to agree. Okay,
there has to be some point in time when a couple is married in God's sight. Like a couple on the island, you use as an example. Mm-hmm. You also have an exception. If we get off here alive, we're really not married, but as long as we're here together, things like that, you're going to end up in these right areas where...
No, now if they do it with that intent, their intentions are wrong. Because that marriage is just as binding as... You see, you can be out on a ship, and the captain of a ship can marry you. Because on the high seas, the captain of a ship is sovereign, just like he were a country to himself. You can go down here to the country of Tanzania and be married according to their laws. Wherever you marry, under what society and in what framework, you need to fulfill the law of that land. A Mexican marriage, as far as I'm concerned, is just as legal as any other, even though it's not recorded anywhere in the States.
Yeah, I'm talking about God, but I'm not talking about satisfying man-made laws.
The only reason you need to satisfy the man-made laws is because God says obey the law of the land. Does anyone not understand that? Paul is not dealing in 1 Corinthians 7 with the case of fornication. He's not dealing at all with the acceptive clause. But, Billy, again, in answer to your question, you see, if verse 39 was considered to be isolated and you couldn't understand it in the light of anything else, then even Matthew 19:9 would be nullified. Matthew 19:9 injects sort of what Jesus did in Matthew 4 and verse 4 when he said, again it is written. The devil said...
That's the reason I brought it out, is because Brother Adams teaches in 15 that it does mean you can be, you know, remarried.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to take one verse and isolate it, like you talked about 39, well, you might do that, but I think that you've got to take them all into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And that would wipe out any doubt in my mind that you could remarry from what it says.
Let me point out to all of you that even in the brotherhood, some of the finest scholars, not only in the secular world in writing commentaries, but in the religion, in the Lord's church, some of the finest men, men who you could not question their motives and say, well, they're just downright snakes or trying to approve of fornication or something, have disagreed on this issue. For example, R.L. Whiteside was probably one of the finest scholars that there ever was in the Lord's church. He wrote the famed commentary on the book of Romans. And Brother Whiteside believed that this phrase in 7:15 allowed remarriage in the case of a believer who was abandoned.
In other words, if a man commits murder, he becomes a criminal. A man who steals is a criminal. Well, because the man...
...country with bugles saying, hey, everybody, you know, if you're married to an unbeliever, you can just waltz off and get married. It's a matter of personal conviction, and there are others who are equally honest on the other side. And if we have any delusions in this class that we could just solve it, even if we all came to the same conclusions, said we all agree this is the infallible answer, you might get out of this classroom and find out still, well, there's a whole world out there where a lot of people disagree. So it is a difficult problem. But again, it is mostly for our consideration academic, because you would very, very rarely run into a situation where this thing even comes up. And if you do, in 9 times out of 10, well, I would say 10 times out of 10, there's going to be fornication on the part of an unbeliever that runs off. So I just don't know that it has any practical application.
The damage is trying to teach the kids before the marriage that there is a place to get out of it.
We covered that very thoroughly last week, didn't we?
Pretty much.
I think that that is really one of the things that we can all agree on in this class, and that is that when you have, not just kids, Horace.
Yeah.
Now, I've been preaching on marriage in the home for a long time now, and I haven't been saying a lot about, now, on loophole A, you can divorce your wife this way, and on loophole B, you can get rid of your husband this way. The main thing that gospel preachers in the church needs to concentrate on is the fact that God's general rule is one man and one woman for life.
I think that's really taught kids, too, rather than, you know, what it might mean and what it may say. They should be taught that there's one man and one woman.
That's why we don't have kids in classes like this. See? Classes like this where you, I mean, these passages are here, and you can treat them in one of two ways. We can just ignore the passage or sort of tiptoe through the tulips over it and not even just say, well, that's what it says, and let's not talk about what it means. But these classes that are taught on an academic basis are for the mature. That's why we don't invite first and second and third and fourth graders, even junior high school students in here, to come on in and wrestle with some of these things that are for the mature. But we would all agree that the thing to do in handling questions regarding marriage and divorce in the home is not to emphasize the escape hatches, but is to emphasize God's original plan for marriage, the permanence of marriage, and how to solidify and hold the home together as God would have it, so that there can never, ever, ever be a divorce or a split up in a marriage without there being sin on somebody's part. You see? Now, there can be an innocent party, yeah, but there can never be a divorce without there being sin on somebody's part. I'm not trying to avoid this. I will tell you now that I will cover this more. I will probably teach, it may be a year or so, but there will be a class called Church Problems. And in this class, one of the things that will be discussed is the question of marriage, divorce, and remarriage, in which we'll take all of the positions, see what all of them say, and let different people take different positions, and then whatever they take, try to pick it apart, and really get into this thing in a deep way. Is anybody mad at me? You see? Thank you. Well, you know, it's a tough thing. One thing, let me ask that if you ever disagree with me in this class, because you disagree with me, do not impugn my motives and say he's trying to be liberal or he's trying to be dishonest or he's trying to teach false doctrine. Because if I know my own heart before God Almighty, I have no desire in this world but to teach just what this book teaches. And if we don't have time to discuss something to your satisfaction in this class, then let me ask that you simply get on the telephone and call me up and say, "Say, Bill, come over to the house and let's sit down at the kitchen table where we can talk about this thing for 2 hours unhampered." And I'll do it. I'll be over. So I have people that say things in classes that I teach, and I think that sure is a stupid idea. And you may be sitting there, and someday I'll say something. You'll say, "Well, that sure is a stupid statement." But let's not fall out over it. Let's maintain mutual respect. And I think that we're going to find out about that very thing that I'm talking about in chapters 8, 9, and 10. May we proceed now? Okay. This is fine. Not been time wasted. Glad to be able to discuss that. Now, the average Christian doesn't have a lot of trouble in distinguishing between things that are absolutely good and things that are absolutely bad. But when it comes to that wide, slippery, gray area that's sort of a no-man's land of doubtful issues, most of us start to scratch our heads. Is it right to go to services every Lord's Day? Well, we don't have any doubt about that. Is it right to be baptized for the remission of sins, to partake of the Lord's Supper? Is it right to be benevolent? Is all of that right? Yeah, no doubt about that. Is it right to murder somebody or commit adultery? No, no, no. That is on the absolute blacklist. But the things that cause problems are those gray area issues, like what about going to movies? And then if you make a decision on that, what about G-rated and possibly what about PG-rated and what about R-rated and what about X-rated? See, how do you cut the line there? What about smoking? What if I don't inhale if I smoke? If you say it causes cancer, I just, you know, or holding a plug of tobacco in my mouth. What about drunkenness? No question that that's wrong, but what about social drinking? What about a little wine for my stomach's sake, like Paul said? Medicinal value? Well, most Christians would say that's fine. What about, maybe a glass of wine before a person goes to bed at night? What about, on the other hand, going out to parties where there's the clinking of the glasses and you're doing it out socially? Where do you cut the line? On the other hand, what about going out and playing baseball on Sunday? Some people don't think you ought to do that. How short or how long must my skirts be if I'm a woman? Can I buy into certain kinds of businesses? If certain businesses do things that are questionable, may I even own stock in that business? See? And now you get into areas that fades from absolute black and white to varying shades of gray. And these questions are so complex that in many cases, even Christians in the same local congregation can't agree. You don't have to go from Texas to Tennessee to Canada to New Zealand to find variances, and sometimes Christians even in the same family, husbands and wives, would take different positions on some of these things. What about my daughter being in the band or in the cheer squad that has to wear a skirt so short? What about her being one of the twirlers, or I'd want it, and I say, yeah, well, it's all right, you know. If we say no, no, no all the time, no telling, she may go completely wild, and the wife says, well, I just don't think it's right, so we have a squabble over it, see. Where do you draw the line on those things? Well, what you do is you let the preacher be the lawmaker, and in every issue that comes up, you just go to him and say, Brother McQuestion, what shall we do on this? Well, that would be a cop-out kind of situation. Well, back in Corinth, there may not have been many arguments about going to movies or wearing miniskirts, but they had the same kind of problems. The main point of contention of all things was eating meat. And although it may seem strange to us, one of the serious temptations of the first century Corinthian believers involved worshiping idols. No one had a question in his mind that idol worship was a sin. Everybody knew that idol worship was sinful. No spiritual Christian would even think of doing that. It was just as easy as black and white. But there were shades of gray that appeared when some of the cultural overflow of idol worship began to spill over and touch Christians. For example, how about eating some of the meat that the pagans had offered to their idols? Could we do that? Would it be harmful? Could a Christian do it? Was eating the meat the same as worshiping the idol to which it had been sacrificed? Might it be what the Bible calls the appearance of evil? Now, what we're going to be talking about in this series is what we call amoral issues. Now, the word amoral, the word a, simply means non. For example, another word that is like that is the word atheist. Now, the word theist, as you know, means God, from the word theos, God. And atheist means non-God, one who does not believe in God. An amoral issue is a non-moral issue. It is an issue to which no moral connotation is attached. It is neither intrinsically right or wrong. It is non-moral. It is amoral. That's a word that you need to learn. Now, one of the problems that we're going to get into is that in the mind of the person who thinks he's a mature Christian, that has everything figured out, issues that I consider an amoral issue, he doesn't consider an amoral issue. He knows it's sinful, and he knows why it's sinful. You can take anyone in the church that has any quirk. For example, there'd be the issue of women wearing pants. In other words, some of you ladies have on things and not skirts, in other words. Some people maintain that that's a sin. And on the issue of smoking. Now, the Bible does not say, thou shalt not smoke, but everyone has a series of arguments. Well, first of all, it lessens your influence, it harms the Bible, and some of these arguments may be valid. But we get out of the realm of things on which the Bible just says, yes, you can do it, or no, you can't do it. So we might have in our minds, we might have two lists. First of all, there's the list of things that are absolutely white. And I used to hear preachers preach sermons, and I've heard many, many of them say, so many people think that there are things that are over here in the gray area. But there just isn't any gray area. Everything is either white or it is black. It is either right or it is wrong, and there is no gray area. Now, as I said, to the person who has it all figured out, as we're going to see these people in Corinth, that which really was white, they thought was black. And so, just because if we could all agree on what the black issues are and the white issues are, we all agree on that, I'm sure there are two lists in the Bible that give the black issues. For example, in 1 Corinthians 6, we have there, Paul says, these won't inherit the kingdom of God, and he names certain things. And then in Galatians 5, 19 through 21, we have there, where Paul mentions those that won't go to heaven, those that do the things in the blacklist, they just won't go to heaven. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And on the other hand, in Galatians 5, there's some things that are mentioned that are fruits of the Spirit, that are absolutely good and always good under all circumstances. But then there are those things that we're going to talk about between. Now, it's true today that eating sacrificial meat doesn't pose a problem for us. But 1 Corinthians 8 through 10, which deals with this problem in detail, is extremely important because it gives us some basic principles of Christian ethics, that is to say, moral values, which will help us to decide any doubtful, now that's another word for gray, it's doubtful. In other words, I don't know. Is it right or is it wrong? It's doubtful. These principles will help us decide any doubtful issue that may touch our lives. And I have never met any Christian that is completely free from this kind of problem. Now, eating meat is what is known as an amoral issue. This has to be kept in mind in fully understanding this section of Scripture. It is neither moral, like loving one's neighbor, that's a moral thing to do, that's on the white list, nor is it immoral, like murder. It's just neutral. For example, the issue of eating hamburgers. The issue of eating hamburgers is an amoral issue. If I want to say, I will never eat another hamburger as long as I live, fine. If, on the other hand, I want to say, every day, as long as I live, from now on, I'm going to eat a hamburger every day, fine. That's my business. Now, somebody would come along and say, don't you know that they put monosodium glutamate in the meat? It's a preservative, and they've proven that it causes cancer, and so they start making the same arguments as on smoking, see. In fact, I started to even write a sermon on the sin of using saccharin. In other words, anything, the sin of bleached white flour, the sin of too much sugar, dangerous. You're to guard your body. You're to protect your body. The body is the temple of God, and these things are bad for you. So, don't you see, almost anything that you want to attach some evil to, you could use some principles and do that. Now, eating a hamburger, though, for our purposes of discussion, is an amoral issue. It's just like eating meat, it has no moral significance, ethical significance, one way or another. Now, if we can be perceptive enough in this class and next week to capture the doctrinal insights that Paul, by inspiration of the Lord Jesus Christ, imparts in these chapters, we will be able to resolve any doubtful gray area problem that presents itself or may bother us. For the Corinthians, the problem was meat. For you, it may be going to movies. It may be playing cards in your home. It may be listening to country and western music. You know, a man that said it was absolutely a sin to ever listen to country and western music. You know, all it's about is drinking and divorces and cheating and that kind of stuff. It's just filthy trash. And, of course, I totally rejected everything he said because I just loved listening to country and western music. But anyway, he had some definite persuasions about that. So it'll help us to solve these issues, and it'll help us to solve them under varying situations. What would you do under situation A, B, and C? Now, what were the Corinthians up against? With the exception of a relatively small Jewish colony that existed in that city, the whole population of the city of Corinth was nothing but pagan Gentiles that practiced idolatry, which was associated with fornication. It was their national religion. And the worship of idols went along with it. Don't forget there was the temple of Aphrodite with the 1,000 prostitutes there, and this had become the very warp and woof of their lives, you might say, especially of their moral activities. The occasion of a family reunion or any other excuse for there to be some kind of a get-together would turn into a feast that was devoted to some kind of idol. Now, converts to Christianity immediately renounced all aspects of idolatry. They recognized that an idol is not a god at all, but rather an idol is just an inanimate object. But the social aspects of idolatry were ever present in their lives and presented thorny problems to them because they had to live around these things all of the time. And these involve three places in particular where the Corinthians might obtain idol meat and thus mesh themselves in suspicions that they had gone back to worshiping idols. Now let me tell you what the person would do, worrying about the fact that demons were going to get in him. And then the priest would do one of two things. He would have they had a delicatessen that was associated with the temple, and some of the meat would be sold in the temple there, and some of the meat, they would sell it in the marketplace. Now, it came from the idol's temple. Now, here's the problem that you're presented with if you're a Christian in Corinth. You have vowed that you will have nothing to do with idolatry. But every time you find yourself eating meat, you realize I may in some way be associating myself with idolatry, unless you go to a Jewish butcher shop, unless you go and just buy everything kosher, you may be tainted by idol offered meat. Now, one thing, I may go out here just to the shambles, as it's called in the King James Version. The shambles means the marketplace. And I say, I'd like that piece of meat. And I don't know where it came from. It may have been brought from the temple of Zeus and been offered to an idol. On the other hand, I could go down here, and here's the temple of Aphrodite, and I have no intention of being interested in all the prostitutes that are in there, but I'm hungry and they've got that delicatessen, so I just sort of slip in and I have myself a good meal there at the temple of Aphrodite. Or it might be that somebody who is my next-door neighbor who is a heathen invites me over to his house, and he puts this meat in front of me, and I know, in all probability, being a good heathen, he's had this meat purged of demons by taking it down and offered to the priest. So what do you do? When you're invited over to a friend's house, do you carry your own sack lunch and you sit down, and everybody else starts to eat, and you say, and that's rude. If you ever want to convert that guy, you can't be the kind that's just isolated yourself. How do you handle that situation? So the Corinthians, now they have written this letter to Paul, and in chapter 7, verse 1, Paul says, "Now concerning the things whereof you wrote." And you know how he gives these little quotations where he quotes something they said. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Paul says, yeah, it's good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of fornications, let every man have his own wife, so forth. And he answers them. Now, in chapter 8, Paul says, he starts out again by saying, now concerning things sacrificed to idols. This was their second question that they asked him in the letter. Now, the first place then, let me go back over this again, that you might get meat that had been tainted by idols is in the temple itself. The person throwing the party might buy a steer, turn it over to the priest to prepare for the feast. The priest would butcher the animal, burn the fat in the entrails as a sacrifice to the idol, and then use the rest of the steer as food for a cultic banquet. The priest himself might retain a portion of the meat in payment for his services. If not all the meat were used in the banquet, the surplus would be sold wholesale to the butchers in the public markets. The most luxurious of the idol feasts were held right in the temples. And then, and sometimes, Christian friends or relatives would be invited. Or the second place where the Corinthians traditionally ate idol meat was in private homes. Some, rather than assume the expense of a banquet in the temple, would bring the meat home after the sacrifice and invite their friends there. While this was out of sight of the idol itself, the meat served was identical to that served in the temple. Could a Christian accept an invitation to such a social gathering? In other words, does being a Christian mean that you completely withdraw yourself from the world lest you taint yourself with something that might have a bad connotation? Finally, the public marketers were full of meat that had been sacrificed to idols. Both the worshiper and the priest would often sell surplus parts of the sacrificed item to local butchers, and likely the chosen victims had to be without blemish, and so this was likely to be the very best meat you could get anywhere. Of course, it was impossible to look at a slab of meat and tell whether it had been, you know, as it hangs on the butcher's hook, and tell whether it had been sacrificed to an idol or not. And so this situation left the scrupulous Christian housewives in a quandary when they went shopping. Now, remember that the dominant spiritual quality of the Corinthians was, unfortunately, carnality. They were basically carnal, the Christians. And the same carnality that had led them to divide up into four parties, the Paul party, the Peter party, the Apollos, and the Christ party, had led them to be overly tolerant of sin in their midst, even tolerating fornication and to distort God's standard for sex and marriage. This also led them to take a rather extreme position on the issue of idol meat. Bitter quarrels arose among the Corinthians. Some had rock-firm convictions against eating any kind of idol meat. Here's what some people would say. Idolatry is wrong. If you eat meat, even that you're unsure of, that might have been offered to an idol, the best course, the most safe course, is just not to eat meat. Don't eat it. If you think that it's even come in contact in any way with idolatry, don't eat the meat. So some of them were very, very extremist in their views. They would have rather become vegetarians for the rest of their lives than to take a chance on swallowing a mouthful of idol meat. Now, their basic mistake was to ascribe moral values to an amoral issue. Whenever this is done, trouble is in store. But don't you remember I told you that one of the problems is that to the person that is over-scrupulous on a given issue, to him this thing isn't amoral. It's a moral issue. To the ones in Corinth that said, we can't eat this idol meat, it wasn't a gray area, it wasn't a doubtful issue, it was not an amoral issue. It was just flat wrong. They would have put it right over here in the black category. Now, the group that opposed them, the ones that said, we know there's no idols. You can take a slab of beef over here, and you can put it in front of this rock idol, and you can offer it up and say all these incantations, and you can go over to the idol's stomach, and you can knock on it, and there's nobody home. It's just an inanimate object. It's just like a totem pole. You can whittle it out and set it in your yard and get out every morning at 5 o'clock and bow down to it and worship it, and there's nobody lives there. It's just nothing. And the meat hasn't changed. It's just meat. We know that. So, it's good meat. It's perfectly good meat. We know that. We have knowledge. So we'll eat it. Now, you group of over here that think that it's wrong, you're just crazy. You're over-scrupulous. You're being governed by something that isn't wrong. And so if we want to eat it, we'll eat it. And, you know, your views be hanged. So they were carnal too. Now, their thinking was clearer. They were more knowledgeable. They had a better grasp of the issue. They rightly identified eating meat as an amoral issue, and therefore they were able to look at the problem less passionately. They had rejected idolatry, but at the same time, they did not see anything wrong with eating meat that might have been sacrificed to an idol if their hearts were right with God. After all, isn't an idol just a piece of stone? What difference does it make if a steer has been butchered in front of a store, or whether it's been butchered in a slaughterhouse or in the Zeus temple? The meat's the same. These people went ahead and ate. They ate when they pleased. They ate where they pleased. They would even go in the temples themselves and eat. And by doing so, they infuriated their brethren who thought that meeting, that eating this meat was immoral. Now, Paul, in 1 Corinthians 8 through 10, labels the group of abstainers as being weak, chapter 8 and verse 10. Now, that's strange, because usually the people that take a stand against something and say, this thing is doubtful, this thing may be wrong, it's best not to do it, we regard them as being the strong ones. The more hard line a person is, you think he's strong. In other words, there are people that would say, Brother McQuiston, you are entirely too tolerant. What you ought to be doing tonight is condemning all of these ladies for wearing pants that don't have dresses on, that, you know, that are wearing these pantsuits. And furthermore, some of them have bobbed hair, and you ought to be condemning that, the length of their hair. And, you know, they'd come out with all of their fruit cakiness, and they'd make me look weak. They'd think, you know, you're just weak. But Paul says the over-scrupulous ones were the weak ones, the ones that said don't do it. By implication, the word is not in the text, but the others were strong. Now, you can also use for the word strong, knowledgeable. They were knowledgeable in this issue. But as I said, still they were carnal. He doesn't use this word strong, but it would be a legitimate inference to conclude that Paul thought of the opposing group of those who indulged in the meat as strong Christians. Now, in almost every church of the Lord, you will find strong and weak Christians. If the church is spiritual, now that's a new word. If the church is spiritual, then the weak and the strong will coexist and get along in harmony and in fellowship. This is the way it should be. Now notice this and listen to this very carefully. There is nothing sinful about being strong or weak. Now, do you hear me correctly? There is nothing sinful about being strong or weak, as we're using the terms, which we're going to define further. The body of Christ is made up of both. Sin enters the picture only when the weak and the strong begin to quarrel, and their carnality causes them to break fellowship with each other. And this is what happened in the carnal Corinthian church. Trouble will inevitably arise, and then it will express itself in the form of a two-headed monster. The weak Christians will judge the strong or the knowledgeable as being worldly people. And the strong Christians will hold the weak in contempt as being fanatical or pharisaical. The best expression is found in Romans 14:3, where Paul says, the one who eats, now see, 1 Corinthians, or rather Romans 4, chapter 14 and 15, deal with the same issues as 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. You write down 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9, and 10, and then write down Romans 14 and 15, and they deal with the same questions. Now here's what Paul says in Romans 14:3. The one who eats should not feel contempt for him who abstains, that is, who does not eat, nor should the one who abstains censure him who eats. You see? They get along. They mutually respect one another, and he says, for God has accepted him. Now, carnality will make each group consider itself spiritually superior to the other. This is a curious but important fact. The point is that whether a Christian is weak or strong in the sense that we have been mentioning is not directly related to his spirituality. Whether a person is strong or weak in any given issue can usually be traced not to his spirituality, I hope you're listening to this, not to his spirituality, but it can be traced to his psychological, emotional, and religious background. It can be traced back to his cultural conditioning before he was converted. Being converted to Christianity does not make everyone strong or everyone weak. There are weak Christians who are carnal, and there are other weak Christians who are very spiritual. There are strong Christians who are carnal, and there are strong Christians who are very spiritual. The factor that really makes the difference between spirituality and carnality is never knowledge, but is love. And again, the Corinthians' basic difficulty comes down to their failing to use love to regulate knowledge. Now, let me depart from that. That lays the groundwork. When we're talking about the weak and the strong, we are not generally categorizing Christians as being weak or strong per se in their overall lives. You cannot take this person and say this man is strong and this man is weak. But you have to identify with what issue you're talking about. Both may be equally spiritual. In other words, here, take the meat issue. There were people in Corinth that were spiritual. There were a lot that were carnal, but there were some that were spiritual. Now, here may be two people that are equally spiritual minded. They want to do what is right. No one can impugn their motives. But one of them, because of his background, he's had a background of idolatry. And he's so afraid of idolatry that his scruples about eating meats that's had anything to do with an idol are weak. There's just no way that that man, because of his background and conditioning before he became a Christian, can take a bite of that meat if he knows it's been anywhere near an idol without feeling like he's committing sin. See, he's weak on that issue. Very spiritual, but on that issue he is overly scrupulous. Now, on the other hand, here's a man that is the strong on that issue. He says, I know that it doesn't have anything to do with right or wrong. He said, It's an amoral issue. It doesn't make any difference. I can take that meat and I can just go right to the temple and I can go to that heathen priest and I can say, sell me 50 pounds of meat and I can bring it home, put it in the freezer and I can feed my family on it. It doesn't bother me one bit and I can eat it. I have no qualms of conscience about it. Do you see? They may both be equally spiritual and yet one is overly scrupulous and one doesn't have the scruples. He knows there's nothing right intrinsically or wrong with it. Now, there are several classes of people that we've learned about, which I'll mention now, in the Corinthian letter. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 15, and chapter 3, verse 1, he that is spiritual. In chapter 3, verse 1, he talks about the carnal. And some of the carnal he called babes. Incidentally, there were some who were not babes, but were still carnal. And then there were some who were so-called brothers, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5, 9 through 13, that were immoral. They were just professors rather than confessors. They were just so-called brothers. And they needed to be withdrawn from. And then there were the wise in chapter 6 and verse 5. Or at least there should have been. Paul said, isn't there someone wise among you that can settle these disputes that you have instead of taking each other to law? And then there are the knowledgeable. Chapter 8 and verse 1 and chapter 8 and verse 10. And then there are those that have love. And then there are those who are weak in conscience. Now, let's get into the text and start in as time permits and go through. I think this is going to give you the answers to these problems. Now, before we get into this text, let me turn over and give you what Paul's solution. Let's answer the problem before we even get into it, so you can see what we're building up to. Turn over to chapter 10 and look at verse 21. Paul really gives three solutions. Paul, first of all, what he's going to do on this meat issue is he's going to agree, listen to me, he's going to agree with the strong, with the knowledgeable. He's going to say that the issue of eating meat is amoral. In other words, it's really not wrong to eat it under any circumstance. You can eat this meat. It is never really a sin in and of itself to eat this meat. Eating this meat is amoral. Now, I asked a question last semester, and I said, those in the church that are weak on a particular given issue. Once again, we're not talking about weak generally. You know, we too often use the term, these are the strong Christians and these are the weak Christians. And we mean it in sort of a general, overall sense. I'm not using the term strong and weak like that. I'm using it as Paul does to describe a person's scruples on a given issue. I may be weak on several issues that you're strong on, because of my background. I may be strong on some things that you're weak on. In fact, I imagine that all of us are strong and weak and have varying degrees of scruples on various issues. Now, Paul agrees with the strong, and I asked the question in class, what do you do in a congregation with those who are weak on a given issue? And somebody raised their hand and said, you teach them so that they become strong and knowledgeable. Well, now that would really be nice if you could do that. In other words, all you need to do, Paul, is just take all of these people that are weak on the issue of eating meat and say, look, we're going to have a 5-night lectureship on this. And we're going to get up and we're going to show all of you that there's nothing wrong with eating this meat. It's just meat, hasn't been tainted. So become strong Christians and knowledgeable Christians and eat the meat and forget about it. And if that was what Paul's decision had been, then he wasted 3 whole chapters telling them about a different way to handle it. Now, unfortunately, in the Lord's church, and a true gospel preacher will praise the Lord's people in what they do that is good and point out what they do that is dangerous. In the Lord's church generally, we have become a people of knowledge, and that's good. But the unfortunate thing is that we have gotten to the point almost where we try to deal with every issue on the basis of knowledge. And what we're going to learn is that Paul says you have knowledge. Knowledge alone just won't cut it. Knowledge has to be governed by something that is equally important, and in some cases even more important, and that is love. Love has to be the governor of knowledge. Too many times an issue comes up in the church and we say, we'll handle that. We'll have a debate on it. We'll get this man to represent this side and this man to represent this side. And all that the debate does is crystallize people in the positions that they're already concreted in on, and it results in a split. But love, on the other hand, causes people who are strong and some who are weak on that issue to be able to coexist and serve the Lord compatibly with one another. So we're going to learn that love is the answer to solving amoral issues. Now, here's what Paul says. Now, bear in mind that Paul says It's all right to eat this meat. It's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. Nothing in the world wrong with it. In other words, technically, if I said, Paul, would it be all right for me to go into the Aphrodite delicatessen and sit down and eat a meal? I'm not going to go in there and commit fornication. Paul would say, yeah, that's all right to eat that meat. Nothing's wrong with eating that meat there. But when we wind up, Paul is going to say, don't do that. Don't do that because love dictates that somebody is going to be watching you and they're going to see you go into that idol's temple that is weak, and they're going to see you and they're going to think, oh, he's just having a meal after having had a nice toss in the hay with the prostitutes here. They're not going to know that you've just gone in there to eat the meal, see? And remember that somebody is always watching you. If you turn over to the 8th chapter, Paul says here in verse 10, for if a man see thee, and that's something to bear in mind. People are always watching. See? Now let's say that I agree that it's all right to drink a little wine for my stomach's sake. Let's say I have some infirmity and the doctor says, what I want you to do is go down and get a little wine and drink a little wine for your stomach's sake. But still, what I would be doing is going across town, you see, and I would be tiptoeing into some place where I would be sure nobody would know me, and then sure enough, somebody would see me anyway. It's like the story of the two preachers that always wondered what liquor tastes like. They didn't know. They'd never had any. And they were coming back from a meeting, and they were thousands of miles away from brethren in the Rocky Mountains, and they went in through this town, and they got to talking about that, and one of them said, well, let's try it. So they went through this town, and they turned into the red light district, and they turned down one street, and down another street, and down an alley, and down a little thinner street, and they parked behind this bar, and they sneaked in through the back door, and it was dark in there, and each of them ordered a little jigger of whiskey, and both of them stood there and drank it at the bar, and after they had done so, one of them said to the bartender, said, how much do we owe you? He said, oh, it's okay, it's on the house, we don't charge preachers. Somebody is always watching, you see. So he says, if a man see thee, for if a man see thee who has knowledge, that is, you have knowledge, sitting at meat in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he is weak, be emboldened to eat things sacrificed to idols? In other words, he's weak, you're knowledgeable, you know there's nothing wrong with it, and so you go in and eat it, but somebody sees you that doesn't have the same knowledge that you have, and he's weak on that issue, and it causes him to stumble. So here's how Paul is going to answer it if you turn over to chapter 10, verse 21. Situation number one, Paul is going to say, in an idol's temple, ye cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. Ye cannot partake of the table of the Lord and of the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? Are we stronger than he? Paul's answer is, do not go into an idol's temple and be eating this meat. If you do, it's just provoking the Lord's to jealousy, and the only way you could do it successfully is if you're stronger than the Lord himself. Now bear in mind, Paul's reasoning is not because it's wrong to eat that meat in there, but the thing that is wrong is when you go in that idol's temple, you are putting yourself in a situation to cause other people to stumble, and not only that, you're putting yourself in a situation where you may stumble. You may fall into some of the heathen. You go in, there's a gay party going on in honor of this idol, and there's all kinds of debauchery, and before you know it, well, you've been caught up in the whirl of the party. The second answer that Paul gives, read verse 23. Again, he affirms what he said over that we read a moment ago in you know, a little earlier when we read this in chapter 6 and verse 12. All things are lawful, but not all things are expedient. That is, even among those things that are lawful, not everything is edifying. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. Let no man seek his own, but each his neighbor's good. Whatsoever is sold in the shambles, now that is the marketplace, eat, asking no question for conscience' sake. Now, situation number two is marketplace, meat, eat, and don't ask questions. In other words, eat it and don't make a fuss over it. Then the next situation that he gives is, well, he says in verse 26, why you do that? For the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. If one of them that believe not, that's a non-Christian, biddeth you to a feast, and ye are disposed to go. Now, what does the word disposed to go? You may not be disposed to go. Do you have the right to decline an invitation? Yeah. But if you're disposed to go, is the Christian sealed off from the world so that he cannot go? No. Whatsoever is set before you, eat, asking no question for conscience sake. Once again, that's your conscience. But if any man say to you, now here's this guy sitting next to you, but if any man say to you, this hath been offered in sacrifice, eat not for his sake that showed it. In other words, for the sake of the man that whispered this to you. And for conscience sake, conscience I say, not thine own. In other words, not because it's going to hurt you or you're going to think you're violating your conscience, but the others. For why is my liberty judged by another's conscience? Now, that's a good question, but he's going to show my liberty is judged by another's conscience. Now, I go over to a friend's house. And the answer is A, sometimes, yes, and B, the answer is sometimes, no. Do you see the solutions? Now, Paul says there's nothing wrong with eating meat. Really, there wouldn't be anything wrong with eating meat in an idol's temple? Fine. There wouldn't be anything wrong, per se, with eating the meat from the market or in the friend's house, regardless of who knows about it. But Paul says, here's how you handle it. As far as going into a temple, because it puts you in such close juxtaposition with idolatry, refrain from it. On the other hand, if you go to the marketplace, there's a good possibility that they brought that here from the temple of Zeus. But don't be going around saying, did you get this meat from the temple of Zeus or one of the heathen priests? It looks like a good slab of meat. Just buy it. Be thankful. It's good meat. Go home and say, thank you, Lord. Give thanks for this good meat. And don't worry about it. Eat it. Don't ask any questions. Don't make any fuss. And if your Christian friends comes over, he shouldn't be saying, where'd you get this meat? He shouldn't do that. And even if he does, you can just say, I bought it in the market. And if he says, well, was it meat that had come from an idol's temple? Then the answer to that would be, well, I don't know. I never make an issue out of that. I don't think it's that's important. It's just good meat. Now, if you go over to a friend's house and the friend sets a big steak in front of you, you don't say, where'd you get this meat? You just eat. But if somebody sitting there reaches over and says, say, this came down from the temple, then if you go ahead and start eating, he's probably just testing you as a Christian anyway, trying to get you implicated in idol worship. So he says, don't eat for conscience sake, not for your conscience, because you know there's nothing wrong with it, but for his conscience that revealed it to you. So there are situations that you're going to face in life that are comparable to this, and I'm going to have you make a chart out of this. I'm going to have you analyze certain situations when I give you your test over 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. And I'm going to ask you to categorize these things. In other words, you're going to say, if I asked you now, let me ask you a few of them. Just movies. If I said movies, well, what would your answer be? All right, movies themselves would be amoral, wouldn't they? As a general category, that's what we're talking about, general category. And there would be sometimes, even if it's a good movie, there'd be sometimes when you'd go and sometimes when you wouldn't. For example, would you go at 9:30 on Sunday morning? That'd be a sin, wouldn't it? Something else, another factor would be involved there. What about X-rated movies? Which category would you put that in? Like an idol's temple. Don't ever go. What about, let's take dancing. What about ballroom dancing where men and women, unmarried to each other, hold and fondle as they dance, as it were? What would you say about that? What would be your judgment? We're asking your judgment on this. I'd say, like meeting an idol's temple, never do it. What about dancing with my wife in the privacy of my home? You might ask some questions.
Put it down there where you've got some kind of gift. Depending on who's around.
Good thinking. What about a man and his wife in the privacy of their bedroom? Well, go ahead and do it and don't make a fuss out of it.
Well, that's what it might lead to, Will.
You heard that somewhere, haven't you? Now, that was said to me one time by, there was a young man that was talking to me about that, and he just said dancing was wrong, period, per se, in and of itself. Situations had nothing to do with it. And I said, well, you mean to tell me it'd be wrong for a man to dance with his wife in the privacy of his home? And he said, yes. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, because of what it might lead to. Well, you know, what if it leads to it? I don't care. Okay, but on the other hand, as Billy mentioned a moment ago, what about a husband and wife dancing together? You go over to a friend's house and they have a little party and all of a sudden somebody puts on some music and couples get up and start dancing. No, I'd say over here, don't do it. Okay. What you have to do is, once again, when you discuss these issues, what we're going to have to do is discuss the cultural framework in which we are discussing these. In other words, there's the word paradigm, which the word paradigm describes the cultural framework in which we're talking about this question. Now, let me tell you, Karen, that if you lived over in India and you lived in the cultural restrictions of that society, you would not be wearing pants tonight if you wanted to be viewed as a Christian.
What about that I know that at least one person at Bel Air, things wrong with me, were in any time, if particularly the church.
Let's hold off on that just a minute. Okay. All right.
But,
well, okay, we'll talk about that. But in other words, over in India, there's no way that a Christian is going to wear that. In fact, a Christian in India would not wear lipstick, would she? That's a sign of a prostitute. There are certain countries where wearing hose would make you look like a prostitute in the eyes of the people. You're not going to do it in that cultural framework. But over in our cultural framework, probably 30 years ago, some of you ladies would not be dressing like you are now. You would not have cut your hair the way you are now. Now, what we're going to learn also is that does custom define morals? Is first of all, let me ask you this. Is custom the absolute definitive factor in morals? No. Because what if custom said everybody goes naked? Obviously, you can't take it that far. But while custom does not define morals, custom does, in some sense, regulate morals and our outlook on issues which are amoral as to whether it would be proper or improper in that given framework, right? Now, you know, you asking about that dance, and I agree with you, Bill, I wouldn't dance, you know, in somebody's home, so forth. But let's say I was over in Bavaria, and, you know, they had this kind of dance, where everybody just jumps up and down, and friends get together, and they have these dances like that. It might be possible that Christians would engage in something like that, and it would not be looked upon by society in the same way that ballroom dancing would be over here. In the same way, when you go over to France and to Italy, they look at the drinking of wine in a different way. There are people in the church. Brother Cogdell just came back from Italy, and you know, he told us about how members of the church over there would drink wine. And certainly he preached against drunkenness, and he also preached against the dangers of social drinking, which would lead to drunkenness. But there might be a man that could even serve as an elder in that particular framework, that when he eats his meal, he drinks a glass of wine. It is not looked upon in the same way that it is looked upon in this particular framework. Now, we don't have any problem over meat. You know, there's no danger of Bel Air having a big kerfuffle and splitting over he's getting his meat down at market, and here's where it's come from. It's just meat, and there's no issue over it. But if we can apprehend the principles that Paul applies to meat, and he winds up by saying there's nothing wrong with it, but under some situations you would totally, under some situations you just go ahead and do it, you wouldn't ask any questions, and on some situations you might do it and you might not do it. And so what we're going to learn is that there are some gray areas. Let me ask a few questions before we close here. Would you say that all issues are either black or white? Let's get some consensus of the class. If there's anybody that has that impression that all issues are black and white, see, if that were true, then Paul would have just said, eat the meat or don't eat the meat. He wouldn't have bothered to categorizing it like this. Do you think that all issues are black or white?
Yes.
Okay.
Because in the framework of the situation in which you live,
mm-hmm.
you can break down the sometimes yes and sometimes no, where you take each and every individual situation and either make it white or black. Whereas the answer white or black, if you go up into Canada, would be a different black and white.
But that means the thing itself is not intrinsically black or white.
Right. Okay, I'll agree with that.
But, But what you're,
situation is either black or white.
What you're saying is that it's the situation that gives it the connotation of blackness or whiteness.
Right.
Okay. See, that, now that's a semantical problem. You're agreeing with me that the situation, not all issues in and of themselves are black or white. All right. Secondly, there are some issues that are neither right nor wrong in themselves, and think about this and answer it. There are some issues that are neither right nor wrong in themselves that might take on a certain rightness or wrongness by virtue of the way people view them in a certain place or culture. Is that right or wrong? Yes. They take on an aura of being right or wrong because of cultural considerations. Just like the meat issue here took on an aura of being wrong in the minds of some people because of their cultural background. Number three, if an issue is an amoral issue, it may be practiced and nothing else needs to be considered. No. You got to take love into consideration, don't you? Which we're going to do a good bit of talking about. Number four, knowledge is the supreme criterion in all issues. No. You're all right. That's right. You're answering right. Now, number five, knowledge is important, but love is the primary criterion in determining many issues.